Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the CEU Press podcast. I'm your host, Andrea Talaber. In this episode, I'm joined by Robert Austin to talk about his new book with CEU Press entitled Royal Fraud, the story of Albania's first and last king. Welcome to the podcast, Robert.
It's a real pleasure to be here.
Could you say a few words about yourself and your background to the listeners just to start us off?
Oh, absolutely. At the present moment, I'm a professor at the University of Toronto's Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy. I teach primarily at the Center for European, Russian, Eurasian Studies. I'm a historian by training, and I've shifted a little bit in my career over the past few years to try to write things that are a little bit more popular and a little bit, less academic.
So today we are here to talk about your book, Royal Fraud, which charts Albania's 20th century history through the life of King Zog I. So could you say a few words about who he was and what was his background?
Oh, absolutely, with pleasure. It's, you know, just as a bit of context, I've always wanted to write a book about King Zog, and it's, you know, probably started thinking about it be more than 30 years ago even, that I started thinking, well, I should write about King Zog. The first thing I did as a PhD student was to write about the period where Zog becomes, you know, primary political player in Albania. But as to this book, Zog, I call him Zog, you know, as Albania's first and only king, which is largely true. In terms of background, Zog was a kind of a typical elite Albanian in the sense that his father was a local regional ruler. He was raised in fairly decent circumstances and, you know, roughly central to North Albania. But he was one of these guys that in the old Ottoman Empire was probably destined for greatness. In any case, even had, you know, counterfactually, Albania stayed as part of the Ottoman Empire instead of becoming an independent state. And, you know, Zog charted a career that I think was in some ways emblematic of some of the other people who came out of the late 19th century Balkans, insofar as that he started as a local chieftain. He worked hard. He intrigued a lot. He was a master plotter, a master intriguer. He was tremendously capable of reading the strengths and weaknesses of his own people. And he charted a path to a kingdom, which probably was his dream, that, of course, ended badly in 1939 when Mussolini and his forces invaded Albania and toppled Albania and integrated Albania into Italy. But that's just a part of the story.
I want to talk a bit about background before Albania becomes independent in 1914. So he was studying in Constantinople as well. How did he get there and what was he doing there exactly?
Well, Zog was one of those guys that, you know, again, in the old Ottoman structure, he's a feudal bey. So it makes him a lord, like a local lord. So I always refer to Zog in the Albanian context as a big fish in a little pond, you know. So he's a top dog in a very small space. And all Albanian young men would have been sent to Constantinople as part of this, you know, almost like a tribute, almost like it's not to ransom or anything like that, but, you know, to join the Ottoman forces and pursue a career that would have been largely military. So that's what sends Zog to Constantinople in the first place. So he would have, and I try to chart that as much as possible. One of the hard things about writing about Zog is that he didn't write a lot down. And he didn't actually say a lot either. So there's not an enormous number of speeches you can consult. And there's not, you know, and when he does tell his life story, it's usually totally embellished. But back to Constantinople, he would have gone there as a young man. He's born in 1895. So he would have shown up in 1908, which, as I try to chart in the book, is really a pivotal year, not just for the Ottoman Empire, but for the whole Balkans, because this is this young Turk revolution. I think to understand the Balkans even today, particularly Albania, but other places, the Ottoman Empire and its disintegration, you need to get the Young Turk Revolution and what it meant. So Zog would have had his first foray into politics there, even as a young man. And remember, like, you can't put Zog in a 21st century or even 20th century context. Like, by 13, he would have had a lot of experience that most people wouldn't have had. So to say, well, he's 13, he's already politicized. He probably was, because he would have experienced this. And he would have met people in the Ottoman Empire, some of them good figures, some of them bad figures. And he studied there, too, at this famous high school, Galatasaray, which is in Constantinople, slash Istanbul. So he gets his foray there. But while he's there, remember, the Balkans starts to disintegrate in dramatic but mostly violent ways. So this is where he sees an opportunity and he pursues it, because the beginning of the Balkan Wars in the fall of 1912 changes the situation completely. And this allows a young person like Zog to enter the political space, even as I said, even as a very young person. So Constantinople transforms him. And it's also, keep in mind, it's his first visit to a city. You know, he's growing up in a very rural setting, very mountainous. You know, his milieu is Albania in the 19th century, which writers in a really derogatory way characterize Europe as what it would have looked like 500 years ago. That's how Albania is described. You know, you can even see headlines that say, Albania is like darkest Africa. You know, this is the characterization. So Zog shows up in the, you know, it's almost Bright Lights, big city for the young and forthcoming King Zog.
So you said he was in Constantinople until 1912, 13?
Yeah, that sounds about right, yeah.
And then, as you said again, that, you know, that's a time when the Balkans in general, but also Albania, is undergoing quite a lot of changes. There are revolts, there's the first Balkan Wars, and then Albania becomes independent. But the great powers impose King Wilhelm of Wied as a king on Albania. So where is Zog during all this? And is he inspired for later to become king by this?
I've always, you know, again, you have to, if I step back a little bit, when I originally started the book, I wanted to do something kind of narrative nonfiction, you know, which would take a largely true story, but add some fictional elements to fill in for where we don't know what Zog's doing. Because as I said, he's not writing down stuff. He's not giving a lot of interviews. So, and then that didn't work out so well. So this is, here we are now with a totally nonfiction book without any, there's some speculative aspects to the book, but that will be clear to the reader. But in 1912, with the outbreak of the Balkan War, Zog does come back to Albania. And he earns a reputation as a fairly capable military fighter. And Zog's reputation is excellent, in fact, as an armed man. Plus, he's a tribal leader, put tribal in quotation marks. So, you know, he comes from a space where he controls a number of men from this area called Mat in Albania, Burel being the largest place as part of Mat. So he has a force. So he fights largely. But Zog would have experienced a lot of horror in that period. And the period of 1912 to the end of the Balkan Wars, I think for Albanian politicians, is very decisive, because what they experience is an obvious attempt to exterminate them, right? So extermination is one outcome, deportation is another one. The other Balkan powers are trying to create a space that's free of the Ottoman Empire, but at the same time means free of Muslims. So the Albanians are, as a majority Muslim nation, are really put under enormous pressure here. And it's a moment for them. What I think Zog learns here is that he does have potential as a political leader, but I wouldn't say he thinks he wants to become king yet. In fact, he's probably opposed to a king. He'll oppose a king twice. He'll oppose the imposition of Wilhelm of Wied, and he'll impose the discussion about a monarchy following the First World War. My belief is that his transformative moment where he really, it's not Constantinople, it's during the First World War when he's in Vienna, because the Austrians bring him to Vienna kind of as a captive, because they understand his political potential. He's got a huge number of troops. So they drag him to Vienna, and he must have loved it there. And he maintains, and I document in this book, he maintains this really peculiar love of Austria, which is kind of ironic, because I also really love Austria, but for maybe different reasons than King Zog. But it's Austria that I think, where he sees the cat, you know what I mean? He sees the castles, he sees the Hofburg, he goes around on the ring tram, and he's like, wow, you know, can I make this, but in Albania, but on a really much, obviously a much smaller scale. That's transformative for him. So the Balkan Wars, but again, Balkan Wars earns him a reputation as a very capable, and not just capable, but very brave military person.
Once the war is over, he becomes Minister of the Interior in the first Albanian government. But in 1924, I mean, you did say he was a master plotter. So I guess this also shows this, that he gets one of his opponents assassinated, but then he has to flee the country. So how does he come back from this? And what was the background to this?
Well, that's the period from 1920 to 24, which ironically, that's my first book, which is this period. I call it Democracy in Chaos, because that, you know, Albania wants to be something different in 1920, because it's got to fight these two tendencies. One is this desire of people to become aware. And by the way, this is Albania's entire 20th century and 21st century, okay, which is, are we an East, a state rooted in the East, or are we a state that's going to anchor itself with these, you know, Western values? So there's a real conflict there. It's still a largely feudal society. So there's a political struggle in there that's fairly dynamic. By the context of the period, it has some democratic overtones. So Zog ends up in this period as probably the most important figure, because as I chart in the book, the person who could have been the most important figure, who's also the most dangerous figure in 20th century Albania, in a list of very dangerous people, by the way, because Albania is filled with really bad actors in the 20th century, is Esad Pasha Toptani, who's his uncle, it's his mother's brother. He's assassinated in Paris. So this changes the political landscape. That's 1920. So Zog charts this course and originally starts as a liberal, pragmatically shifts to the much more conservative forces around the kind of landowning class, which is the dominant one, which was the one that dominated under the Ottoman Empire. And he's ousted in 1924 in a kind of revolution. The communists call it a revolution later. It's more like a coup, but I tend to think most revolutions are really kind of coups. You know, for some it's a coup, for others it's a revolution. And Zog is forced into exile and he chooses Serbia. That's odd, okay? Because the cliche is that Albanians and Serbs don't get along. This is also, it's not anyhow based in reality. Zog goes to Belgrade, lives well there, has lots of money. You know, he's a bit of a celebrity and the Serbs desperately need him because the Serbian government is still determined to destroy Albania completely. In collusion with the Greeks and just, you know, turned into, you know, either Serbian territory or Greek territory. And he plots his return with the aid, military and financial aid of the government in Belgrade. And he recruits, it's a well-told story and it's been told before prior to me, but he recruits these kind of bored white Russian soldiers who are holed up in Belgrade waiting to go back to Russia to, you know, finish off the Bolsheviks, which they don't ever manage to do. So they're bored and then he recruits them and he pays them and he dresses them up in Albanian costume and they march from north to south to Tirana. And by then the population, to me, is so kind of disinterested, like, oh, here comes someone else. You know, they quickly change sides and say, okay, Zog's back, great. So Zog re-enters Tirana triumphantly in 1924 in what's called, it's December, it's Christmas 1924, and in what's called Legality Day. And he throws this old reform government, you know, out, and it starts a whole new agenda, which is the triumph of the conservative agenda. But the key thing is this Russian thing. The Russian influence there is kind of ironic because, you know, especially when you think in today's context of the world, it's interesting that a reform government in Albania, which didn't, you know, probably wouldn't have survived anyway, but is toppled with the aid of Russian forces in December 1924.
So from 1924, he gets crowned in 1928. So what leads him to want to become king from this? What's the trajectory?
So after, in 1924, he comes back. He dispenses with this kind of chaotic, semi-democratic government, and he sends all of its leaders packing. So everyone ends up in exile. And many of those leaders who are in exile, somewhere in Italy, the key one is Bishop Fagnoli. He wanders around Europe. He does end up in the United States as a church leader, but others, particularly these leaders of the Kosovo insurrectionary movement, because Zog is never perceived as someone who will support the Kosovo cause. Zog is a very pragmatic person. He doesn't see that Albania has anything to gain by pushing territorial ambitions vis-a-vis Kosovo inside Serbia. So these leaders are exiled. Many are, and I chart this, many are assassinated under, you know, extremely suspicious circumstances. And slowly but surely, those opposed to him no longer play much of a role. It comes to a head, but in 1931, but I'll try to stick with the chronology you're asking for right now. But in 1924, he's in power. Opposition flees in boats, heads to Italy, you know, to bide their time. Zog links up with the landowning ruling class and establishes a presidential republic. So he shifted from a parliamentary republic to a presidential republic in January 1925. And then in September of 1928, you know, this is when he's crowned king. Again, since he leaves so little behind in terms of his thoughts, he speaks to the idea that the Albanians are natural monarchists because of this kind of tribal structure that he's part of. And that's how he's raised. So he argues that the Albanian people should have a monarchy. But also, when he looks around the rest of the Balkans, they're all monarchies anyway. And a monarchy for the Balkan states is a symbol of stability. So he simply copy-pastes it. He dispenses with the Vid monarchy. Vid wanted to come back, by the way, because he never had anything else to do. You know, that's the problem with all these kind of half-German monarchs who are left over after the unification of Germany. They don't have anything to do. But he imposes this monarchy that he says, again, is the natural order of things. And then he spends the next 11 years trying to make it into something substantial. But he concentrates more on the superficial aspects of monarchy, which is much more about burnishing his own image. He doesn't spend a lot of time you know, trying to transform Albania, because Albania was, you know, to understand Albania, you have to get the context of what its economic situation was, what its political situation. Zog is much more about how does it look, how is he going to be perceived, and less interested in the transformative aspect. And he works, I pointed out in the book, I find it odd, but maybe because he had accomplished so much by then, I find by 1928, Zog almost seems burned out, even though he's still quite young. He doesn't have terrific health, which eventually kills him in 1961. He's kind of sedentary. He smokes a lot. By 1928, he seems well beyond his years. And that could be part of the fact that, you know, by the age of 13, he's already politicized in Constantinople, and he's already accomplished so much. But 1928, and then the only thing I'll add is that, you know, to, as an indication of how the exiles particularly feel about him, he doesn't go out of Albania very often. This also happens to Albania with its communist leader after 1944. They just don't leave. And Zog leaves only once in 1931, and he goes to Vienna because he loves Austria, as I mentioned, and a gang of people try to kill him there. And he's almost killed. He loses one of his closest people, but that's the scene. He never exits the country again until 1939, when Mussolini forces him to exit.
In the book, there's this, maybe it's not a curious relationship between Mussolini and Zog, but he obviously wants to have some kind of a relationship with Mussolini. Mussolini doesn't really want to, but because he wants to get his hands on the oil fields in Albania, he kind of goes along with it. Zog orders an assassination within Italy, and then Mussolini approves his request to become king of Albania. So could you just say a bit about this relationship between the two?
Yeah, again, it comes back to this thing. The Italian archives has more than the Albanian archives. But, you know, Zog is confronted with Albania's dilemma, which is a 20th century dilemma, and it remains a dilemma in the 21st century, which is this: how does the state survive with, you know, inheriting this horrible economic legacy, a feudal system? So, you know, and this bedevils these reform leaders I talked to, too, about as well. So Zog finds that in order to survive, his natural instinct, given where he was in 1924, was to turn to Serbia, or what was called the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes. But when I say Serbia, I mean he's talking to the government in Belgrade. But he changes that position. He largely turns to Mussolini because he doesn't need financial help. He needs financial help to implement a modest reform program. But he's also corrupt. You know, he needs financial help to sustain his you know, kind of pseudo, or, you know, as I say, fraudulent monarchy. So he develops a long-term relationship with Mussolini, which is dependent largely on Mussolini bribing Zog to serve Italian interests. So that by 1926, Albania is not much more than a colony of Italy. And that ends badly, of course, with the invasion in 1939. Zog likes Mussolini, at least as I can gather. Mussolini cannot stand Zog. You know, Mussolini is constantly denouncing Zog as an ordinary bandit. So coming from Mussolini to be talking trash about King Zog, or then at the time Zog, is kind of, in a way, kind of funny, considering the diabolical depravity. And moreover, as I chart in the book, Mussolini kind of hands the Albania file to his son-in-law, Count Ciano. And Ciano has nothing but disgust. I mean, Ciano is so judgmental about the Albanians, he's constantly criticizing or making fun of them. But the relationship is very one-sided, and Zog likes Mussolini, depends on him for cash. And Mussolini views not just Zog, but the Albanians is inherently uncivilized, and that the Italian mission should be to civilize. And remember, when you distinguish between these you know, fascist or Nazi movements, the Italians, you know, will always say, well, we're not conquerors like Germans. You know, we're not trying to enslave people. We're civilizational. So Mussolini argues for a civilizational mission in Albania. And to a point, Zog facilitates that. But Zog can't see the writing on the wall. But Mussolini's playing a long game. And he does want to get back at the Albanians for something that happened in 1920, which was the Italians occupied part of Albania in 1920, and especially in the port of Vlora. And the Albanians, you know, came together and turfed the Italians out. Like this burns in Mussolini's mind. And I think over, as I said, he's playing a long game. So over the long run, Mussolini's definitely going to get back at the Albanians for kicking the Italians out.
You mentioned that he needed cash, and another source of cash that he was trying out was a kind of unorthodox way of finding a bride. You mentioned in the book that he put out an advertisement in the US paper saying that he was looking for a queen, but the queen needs an annual income of at least $1 million. And I mean, I'm guessing there were not too many takers for this offer.
There's very, the quest for a queen, and again, he's engaged early in the 1920s, but he breaks this off, and his future father-in-law will get back at him in a way in 1939, but it's a totally different story. But he also, since he's established this monarchy, he wants to enter one of the kind of mainstream European houses. So he's fishing around for that, but nobody takes him seriously. That's the problem. And he becomes And this, you know, doesn't help Albania in the long run, because Albania becomes kind of an oddity or a curiosity. Some of these oddities and curiosities persist under the communists, and the Albanians become kind of maligned, or at least certainly harshly judged people. So he fishes around to join a mainstream European royal family, doesn't get anybody. Remember one thing, in the time he's king, 1928 to 1939, there's hardly anybody visits him. The only person that sees him semi-regularly was Ciano, but there's no connection between him and other monarchs or other states. It's Albania's, it's as though it's treated already as a kind of protectorate of Mussolini's Italy. So when he starts fishing, he does want someone that does have some money. That's his first goal. So he seeks the Italian house, he seeks the Greek house, the Greek royal family. He's all the, even Ottoman, which is defunct. You know, his sister marries one of the old part of the Ottoman ruling elite. But he settles on this Hungarian, which probably for him wasn't how he expected it to play out. But that's where he ends up. And she doesn't have any money. Although she proves to be in the long run, and Albanians still to a degree probably hold her dearly, she proves to be in the long run kind of a formidable person who does her best to represent Albania after the collapse of his kingdom, and remains a figure of some importance until her death, right? But she's not the first choice, but they, as far as I can tell, she was totally devoted to him, and she tried to make the best of a life that wasn't what she expected, which was to end up to get married in 1938 at a time of great precarity in Europe, right? I mean, 1938 for small states in Central Europe and Southeastern Europe is a disaster. The world is completely being taken apart. And so her life ends up as one in exile, but she wears it well. And in some ways she wears it better than him.
You said that the population liked her and still remembers her fondly to some extent. So what was the relation between Zog and his people?
Oh my goodness, that's probably the easiest question, because Zog never, you know, Zog wasn't a personality cult guy. He's a very isolated king. And, you know, other authors have written that, you know, he didn't tour around the country, for example. He was always afraid of assassinations. He had accumulated a lot of people that wanted him dead. So I would argue that Zog didn't really have a connection to the people, because he didn't seek one. He did occasionally send his sisters on these little goodwill tours, who became princesses. But Zog's fear of his opponents ensured that he stayed largely in the confines of his two castles, one in Tirana and one in the coastal city of Durrës, which he didn't really use that much. But he was a very isolated guy. The population would have had very little connection to him at all. And the population in again, 1920s, 1930s Albania was in a, you know, in absolutely dire economic situation. Remember, Albania stays feudal until the communists come to power. And that's 1944. So the indicators of Albania are different than anywhere in Europe. And that's why its outcomes are different. So I always remind people, like, Albania doesn't have a university under Zog. You know, if you want to go to university, you have to study abroad. The best example of that is Enver Hoxha, who becomes Albania's communist dictator after 1944, who gets one of these scholarships that the kingdom offers. But there's not a great schooling system. There's not a great road system. And that's essentially how he leaves the country. He doesn't make huge efforts to transform the place. Some credit him with this building, you know, helping build an Albanian national identity, which is true to a degree, but it's not as big a deal as some authors make it, because that wasn't his thing. To me, Zog was largely an ordinary criminal whose main determination was to stay in power and get as much money as he could. Because at the end of the day, Zog was also extremely greedy. And that's indicated throughout his regime.
His kingship comes to an end in 1939 when, as you said before, Italy invades and King Emmanuel III becomes king of Albania. And this starts Zog's exile, first in Greece, in Egypt, and then in France. And while I was reading the book, I thought it was quite interesting how it turns into almost like a spy novel when he's in exile, because the US and the UK, while he's in Egypt, they are engaging him to intervene and topple the new communist government in Albania. So what was this story? What happens? And are there any results to this?
Yeah, that's probably probably the part that other authors have written about. I tried to take it a bit further because there's some new documents out that you can get through the United Kingdom regarding these machinations. So Zog, in 1939, you know, the Italians say, this is it, you know, and they give all kinds of spurious reasons for invading Albania. The ironic thing about all this stuff is that when you listen to why people invade countries, you know, the list of excuses you can use is kind of limited. So Zog is faced with this list of reasons from the Italians that doesn't look dissimilar for the reasons reasons that, you know, Russia invades Ukraine, which is that we have to, you know, there's Mussolini saying we have to protect Italian citizens. Zog's about to start a war against Yugoslavia, like all kinds of nonsensical reasons that cannot be believed by any normal person are thrown at Zog. And Zog says, I got to, you know, what am I going to do? He talks about resistance, but decides it's not worth it and takes off. His Queen Geraldine leaves a bit before him. And he begins this kind of peripatetic exile, with the one in Egypt being the most significant. This is after stops in Greece, through the Baltic states, you know, France until it's the fall of France, and then UK at the Ritz, where he's kind of a local celebrity. He's got tons of money, don't forget. He's not poor. He's drained the treasury. He's got all the jewelry from weddings and stuff like that. He's fairly well-heeled, as it goes. And how long the money's going to last, but Zog does think there'll be a moment to come back. Communists, of course, seize power in 1944. They do have an election, but it's communist-style election, which means there's, you know, it's not so much choice. The candidates that are pro-communist obviously win something, you know, the usual 98%. But in the context of the post-Second World War world, in 1945, nobody cares about Albania. It's just not a big issue. If you look at the discussions between, like, Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill, if you look at the percentage agreements and stuff like this, Albania is not even mentioned. It's hardly there as a problem or an issue. And the Americans, of course, considered it almost no strategic value. But the world changes for Albania in 1948, when Albania breaks with Yugoslavia, with Tito's Yugoslavia, and charts this course that it's very Stalinist and very much allied to the USSR. Because all of a sudden, if you look at the map, Albania, which is sitting there on the Adriatic Sea, takes on a new strategic value. So they decide in a fairly significant way for the time that, hey, let's topple a government and let's go with the easiest one, the one that's cut off. It's, you know, Yugoslavia's, you can't invade through Yugoslavia, obviously, the Soviet Union can't. You can't invade through Greece. Albania looks like ripe fruit. So they launched this campaign that lasts many years to try to topple this government. It's a total failure. It costs, you know, quite a significant number of human lives, of people who are parachuted in, these exiles who are given very poor training. But Zog comes back to the table, so to speak, because he's by then in Egypt, under the protection of King Farouk. And the CIA particularly engages Zog because they consider him a capable interlocutor. But he's mostly valuable because he does still have a network that he can help to apply to these, at the end of the day, very catastrophic missions, multiple missions into Albania to infiltrate and build up a groundswell of support to topple the regime, which will begin this domino effect. You know, once Albania falls, then everything's possible. So Zog briefly has a stint of celebrity, and he sees himself as maybe a future role. But he's pretty, by then, his ambitions become a bit more modest, in the sense that he's saying, okay, I'll go back. Maybe I won't be king. Maybe we'll let it really be decided by the will of the people. But he does desperately want to go back to Albania. And Zog and his son, Leka, of course, would have spent most of their days pining in a serious way for the, you know, for the mountains and the simplicity of life that they had left behind. So he briefly is back at the table, but eventually, as an asset, and that's what they refer to him as an asset, an intelligence asset, he becomes useless. And they, like any other asset at the time, he simply gets dropped.
So within communist Albania, how is his image presented, or is it presented at all? Or, you know, how is the interwar years of King Zog explained away?
One word: catastrophe. Zog is enemy. Zog is enemy number one for a period in time when they find another enemy. But at the beginning, the regime is concentrated on eradicating the legacy of the interwar period. Not just Zog, but the people around him. So there's, you know, there's that. Plus they wage this other war, which is an entirely different story, against the Catholic Church, but in religion more generally, which comes later. But Zog is treated as an ordinary reactionary, to the term, who plundered the nation. But his period as the enemy number one in the Albanian communist context is short-lived, because he's not that important, and his legacy is kind of wiped out quite easily, because it wasn't that much there. And plus, remember, Albania is mostly illiterate in 1944. It's not that difficult. The communists are going to make the country illiterate, but Zog left the country with 80% illiteracy rates. That might even maybe is higher. The figures vary widely when you read about that. But the communists dealt with him as an enemy only for a few years, because they developed a new enemy, which was much more important and much more useful for mobilization, which was Tito and Yugoslavia. Like, after 48, for the biggest chunk of Albanian history, it's Albania's relationship, or even more importantly, Hoxha's relationship, the communist leader's relationship with Tito, that shapes the kind of narrative of dangers and threats to Albania. Zog, he's yesterday's news, and when he dies, hardly anybody even notices.
He dies in 1961 in Paris. This, however, does not mean the end of the Zhoug dynasty. In the chaos following the collapse of communism, Zhoug's heir, Prince Leka, attempted to return as the king of the Albanians. I mean, he obviously does not become king, but how is he received? Did he have any support or any chance of becoming king?
There's not much left of that monarchy now, but Zhoug, as you said, dead in April 1961, near the kind of day, that anniversary of his departure, because he left in April 1939, buried in a Paris cemetery among some loyal followers with a very kind of ornate gravesite. Leka crowned king. Leka spends, off and on in exile. Leka's trained militarily, gets good schooling. He's a very educated guy and has a kind of dubious career. But having said that, when Leka's trying to do his own things to topple the communists throughout the period, which are more or less hopeless, right? Nothing he does has any influence. And he doesn't have a constituency inside Albania. To Zog's point, I don't think Albanians are natural monarchists at all. But with the end of the regime in 91, which is also telling because the rest of the communist bloc collapsed in 1989. That's the kind of year, the emblematic year. Albania's a bit later because Albania is really different. Everything about Albania is different. And that doesn't mean communism could have survived, but Albania's following a trajectory that is unlike other states. The only state you could kind of compare with would be North Korea to a degree, or even Romania. But surely Albanians are, if there's a hierarchy of suffering under communist rule, Albanians are pretty close to the top. So with the collapse of the regime in 91, Leka sees an opportunity. But Leka is not the only monarch to see an opportunity. All the Balkan monarchs see like, oh my God, maybe we can come back. This is the worst type of delusional thinking I can imagine, because they just weren't part of the structures anymore. The only guy who made something of it was the king of Bulgaria, Simeon Saxe-Coburgski, right? Who, instead of coming back as king, creates a political party, enters Bulgarian political life because he's actually willing to work hard. At least that's my interpretation. Others could tell me if I'm wrong. Leka, not sure he's willing to work that hard, so he thinks he can come back and the people are going to embrace him. That's just not true. He comes back twice, once, in this attempt, once in 1993 or four, I can't recall exactly. I think it's 93. Doesn't get admitted because of his passport problems. And then comes back in 97 in a civil chaos situation in Albania, which was very precarious, and embarrasses himself in an outrageous way, which is he shows up in camo gear with guns and surrounded by gun-laden people in a time where the last thing people needed was another guy wandering around with guns. And this is where I think he puts paid to any future in Albania, because he makes a complete fool of himself. Absolutely. And it's an embarrassing moment for Albania, for Albanians. And there was a referendum on the monarchy, which he loses. He claims it's fraudulent. I don't really care. It wasn't fraudulent. And if he couldn't win to restore a monarchy in a state of civil chaos, he couldn't win at all. And eventually returns to Albania as as an ordinary person, and he's treated with respect. But his life as a contributor to Albanian issues ends in 97 because of this disgraceful behavior that he employs when trying. It almost looks like a coup. He's dressed for a coup, for sure. Whether he's going to have one is a different story. But he's certainly dressed for a coup, and he's surrounded by people who are chain-smoking Marlboros and firing in the air. Like, at a time when Albanians were terrified and hiding in their homes because the state had collapsed. So who's this guy? He's just one other fool who's entered the foray.
When Zhoug died in 1961, he said that he didn't want to go back to Albania until communism was over. And I mean, I guess he also couldn't have gone back even if he wanted to. So what happens once the communists are out?
Well, that's a kind of long story. Again, he's pretty despondent by 61. Again, the health situation is terrible. The smoking situation, he starts to understand that he's likely not going to be back in Albania. He's born in, he's not an old man by then, right? He's surrounded by his sisters, his devoted wife, his son. With the collapse of the communists, again, after 48, he hardly gets mentioned, as I said. He shows up once in a while, but the history books are written in such a way that the period that matters is this period 1920 to 24, which I talked about, which is Albania's establishing a democracy, and it gets railroaded or sidetracked by the imperialist powers, then Albania is handed over to the fascists, and Zhoug's not a fascist, but he's allied with fascists, and it's all dark. There is a little bit of a renaissance in terms of attitudes towards the monarchy after the collapse of communism, because, in a black and white world, after 91, if Zhoug was bad according to the communists, and the communists are gone, then Zhoug must be good. So there was a little bit of renaissance, and maybe even nostalgia for the period of the monarchy, but most people had grown up under the communist regime. Zhoug is sitting there in the grave outside of Paris, and the new government is not so concerned with him. They're concerned with the legacy of the communists. They're not concerned, but they do rewrite the history of Zog to make it a little bit better. This takes time. As you know, the leader of the communist movement, Enver Hoxha, is summarily removed from his grave of prominence and put in an ordinary grave, which is a, they think is a quick fix. Like, whoa, we'll just get rid of him and put him in a different cemetery and maybe things will get better. They don't. But Zog doesn't really make a homecoming until 2012. And a homecoming being coming home, you know, the return of his remains from France. And I think that that's delayed a bit because the behavior of his son really, I think, would have upset a lot of people from 1997. I don't think it was great. But a center-right government in 2012, which is the 100th anniversary of Albania's independence. Albania's asked for independence in 1912 in Vlora. So 100 years of Albanian independence and Zog's remains come back. And that's the government of Sali Berisha's prime minister. So it's a center-right government. It's a government that's quite isolated. They bring him back and they give him a statue. And they give him a street. He gets buried with a degree of honors. The statue, by the way, has since been moved. It's over. It used to be on the front of the boulevard, and now maybe it's temporary. But he's next to like a bingo kiosk now, or something like that. He's a little bit diminished, but it's not a center right government in power. The thing that Zog comes home, and I write as an ordinary citizen, I don't think it means much to people, to be frank. The only thing that troubled me about Zog was that he came home and. You know, I had written a lot about transitional justice. I really would have hoped that Albanians would have engaged in a much more kind of nuanced assessment of his period. And if they did, in a way, he probably wouldn't have ended up, he could have come home as remains, but I don't think he merits a statue because I don't see his accomplishments as anything but largely negative. So there was no conversation about him or his legacy. And I find that a bit problematic for people to kind of reckon with the past. The focus is all on the crimes of the communists, obviously. But there's another past, too, which was not equally, that's an overstatement, but to a degree, an unfortunate period for Albania. And many of the things happened were largely his fault. So, but we'll see. There's a different government. You know, Albania's been governed by socialists for quite some time now under Prime Minister Edi Rama. I can't see Zog having any space anymore. And maybe the statue move to the corner is just a temporary move. I'm reminded of the moving of the statue of Imre Nagy in Budapest, which is originally of a place of prominence next to the parliament. And then now he's moved close to the Margit Híd. And who knows, maybe that's a step. Maybe it's the same type of thing. Eventually Zog will disappear.
Well, we leave on that note. And thank you for the discussion, Robert. Robert's book, Roy of Rhodes, The Story of Albania's First and Last King, is available to purchase now. The links are in the show notes below. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
It was a real pleasure. I enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you, Robert. And to my listeners, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any of our new episodes. Goodbye.